You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in Talavera de la Reina.
Hello, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of tonight's episode. And as you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am in Talavera de la Reina, or Talavera of the Queen, so called because it was gifted by Alfonso XI, the King of Castile, León and Galicia, to his wife, Constance of Portugal, in the 14th century. Very apt on a somber day at the Vuelta a España, particularly for the British riders in the race, many of whom were wearing black armbands on the stage today. Joining me today from the French Riviera, the Côte d'Azur, but a pure product of the Mitten State, known to you and me as Michigan, it's a man who has ridden four Vueltas a España, won a stage of the Tour de Suisse, been the US National Road Race Champion, and just signed for another year with AG2R Citroën. During this Vuelta, he's made sweeter music than the Temptations. No, not just my imagination. He's laid down smoother grooves than the Four Tops. He wasn't even supposed to be on tonight, but we reached out and he was there. It's the Motown Marvel, our very own Detroit Lion. It's Lucky Larry Warbass.
Hey, Daniel. Good to be back.
Good to be back. Well, good to have you, Larry. We were supposed to have Nicolas Van Looy tonight, the Spanish journalist. Unfortunately, he was ill. He fell ill earlier in the day. I'm reliably informed he's feeling better this evening. But Larry, we did reach out, as did the Four Tops, and you were there, so thank you very much. Larry,
no problem.
To thank you, to express our gratitude, I've got a little present for you this evening. Loyal listeners will remember one of our early podcasts in this Vuelta a España. We talked about your period as a stagiaire. I think it was when you were a stagiaire with BMC in 2012.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, and how you got a bit of a rough introduction to the world of top-tier professional cycling, particularly from two of your teammates, Manuel Quinciato, the Italian, and Marcus Burkhardt, the German. They were so disgruntled with your performance, your lack of assistance on one day in particular, that they christened you the Ghost, which I thought was very unfair. However, I did mention then that Manuel Quinciato is a good friend of mine and of yours, I think, now. Manuel was in Talavera de la Reina this afternoon. Well, and let's hear from him, shall we? Well, Larry, I've got a present for you this evening. We heard you earlier in the Vuelta talk about how you were christened the Ghost, the Fantasma, at BMC by two experienced riders, Manuel Quinciato and Marcus Burkhardt. Well, I'm here with Manuel now. Manuel, do you remember the apparition of the Ghost, Larry Warbass, in that 2012 season?
Yes, I mean, I don't remember exactly, like, if I was calling him Ghost or something else, but for sure was for Larry's good. I don't know if it was clear at the time, but for sure was, of course, I didn't like maybe the way he was racing at the time, but for sure was for on good, no? Because basically in pro cycling, or you win or you have to win. And maybe, you know, I was a young rider and he wanted to hold on as long as possible. And sometimes you didn't see him for a while, then suddenly he showed up like a ghost, as he probably was really a ghost. But yeah, it was no, there was no will to hurt him, but just to try to give him a good advice, let's say.
I think he acknowledges now that it was a good thing for him, but are you proud to see the career that Larry Warbass has had?
So, I mean, I believe that he had the engine. It was amazing to see him winning a stage in Tour de Suisse, and everyone loved Larry, including myself. But, you know, at the end, I think a good friend or a good teammate also tells you what you don't like to hear, no? Otherwise, with a good job, you don't improve. So I hope I'm not going to, like, give to myself any compliment of what Larry did, but I hope that in some way I could have teach him something good.
Well, Larry, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I think you could have recounted the fact that I was a stagiaire as well to him, you know? I think you kind of left that part out. But yeah, no, that sounded about right. I mean, you know, I think our stories lined up, so that was good at least.
a rare occasion when stories do line up on the Cycling Podcast. Larry, today's stage, well, we didn't necessarily expect fireworks, but we thought it was one of those days when it could go either way. It could end in a sprint. It could end in a breakaway victory for someone. We thought there'd be aggressive racing. And we were slightly disappointed, I suppose. But that was largely down to the excellent work by one team, Trek Segafredo. But more of that in a minute. This morning, one of the riders who was certainly very hotly tipped was one of those British riders I alluded to who were wearing black armbands at the start today, and it was Fred Wright. Here's what he was saying this morning in Talavera de la Reina. We also started there this morning.
We are climbing for 18 kilometres twice today, so who knows what the legs are going to be like, but yesterday I chilled as much as I could on the last climb, thinking about today, so hopefully we start with some good legs.
So that was Fred Wright talking about how he tried to conserve his energy at the end of the stage, in the last hour of the stage yesterday. Larry, Fred Wright didn't speak to the press after the stage today because while stage 19 of the Vuelta was underway, we, out of the blue, received a statement, a communique from Jumbo-Visma in which Primoz Roglic, well, he held forth about his crash, the crash that put him out of the Vuelta a España just a couple of days ago, which of course was caused, we discovered later, by a collision with Fred Wright. And well, Primoz Roglic is not very happy still about that crash. He said, "My conclusion is that the way this crash happened is unacceptable. Not everyone saw it correctly. The crash was not caused by a bad road or a lack of safety, but by a rider's behaviour. I don't have eyes on my back, otherwise I would have run wide. Wright came from behind and rode the handlebars out of my hands before I knew it." So I suppose to protect Fred Wright from the inquisition that he was inevitably going to face at the finish, and Bahrain Victorious didn't make him available after the stage, he actually finished the stage in second, as we'll hear in a minute. But before we talk about today's stage, Larry, what do you make of that statement from Primoz Roglic, which I'm reliably informed very much came from Primoz Roglic? It was his decision to say something on the matter today, and to say something, well, quite as explicit as what we just heard.
Well, I would say the first thing of note is that he didn't mention plasticine. So your theory might be out on that one, but, you know, it was a good effort. But beyond that, you know, in all seriousness, you know, I think it's tough because Primoz Roglic isn't the kind of guy who just go up, you know, making up stories and trying to cause drama or anything like that. So, you know, if he felt it really so necessary to release a press release that said, you know, essentially Fred Wright is at fault, it's because he really does believe that he's at fault. But at the same time, you know, I think it's hard for any of us at home to know really what happened, because there was no overhead shot for us to see clearly what exactly happened. And I think the other thing that's hard is that all the guys were, you know, at their limit, at their max heart rate, you know, trying to put every single ounce of power into the pedals as they possibly could, that, you know, they're not entirely lucid. And so even if Fred Wright did bump into him or knock him off his bike, I really can't believe that that was like a premeditated action. You know, I don't think he meant to do it on purpose. Like, I would be very, very surprised if that was something he meant to do. So, you know, I think it's a bit harsh to go after him like that. You know, I guess he's entitled to his own opinion. And if he wants to put that on a press release, he can. So it's not going to be easy for Fred Wright, I guess, you know.
I mean, as I said, I think the initiative to put this out very much came from Primoz Roglic, but it is a team statement. And Jumbo-Visma have couched this within a sort of wider discussion. There's a statement also from their team manager, Richard Plugger, about safety in the sport generally. But it didn't strike me as the kind of crash, the kind of incident that necessarily belongs in that context, because it was nothing to do with a badly designed course or even obviously reckless riding. Like you say, Larry, we don't have the overhead shots, so it's difficult for us to make a call on that. But it certainly didn't strike us as one where, you know, a rider had deviated or a rider had done anything malicious. I mean, I know Fred Wright, after the crash a couple of days ago, has been getting a pretty raw deal on social media, for example. I think he was slightly surprised, perturbed, upset by that. And this certainly won't help matters on that score, will it?
Definitely not. No, I think, it's good that it didn't happen before the stage, because if it did, I doubt he would have been second today. So, I'm sure it's going to be tough for him, but, I guess that's part of being in elite sport, is things like this can happen and you can get caught in the middle of a situation like that. So it's not going to be an easy thing to deal with, but, I guess he'll gain some kind of experience from it. So hopefully it won't affect him too long term, and he'll come out the better for it.
Larry, time is ticking. We're going to have to get on to today's stage. And time is indeed about to tick for you, because you are facing the challenge that we have every day here at the Vuelta a España that we give to our guests. You know what it is, what it's called, what it involves. It is the stage summary time trial. Larry Warbass, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Well, let's go to Rob Hatch.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
And Larry, let's see you roll down the ramp and surmise for us what occurred on today's 19th stage of the Vuelta a España from Talavera de la Reina to Talavera de la Reina.
Okay, well, since you already named the start and finish town, I guess I can miss that part out. It was 138.3 kilometers today. And after a big fight for the break at the start, eventually three men ended up in the main breakaway for the day. Those were Jonathan Caicedo, Brandon McNulty, and Ander Okamika. They were only out front for 73 kilometers because there was a very motivated Trek Segafredo team riding behind. They didn't want to let them too large of a leash, and yeah, they tried to pull them back as soon as they could. What I heard after the stage was that they were worried about a guy like Brandon McNulty being up there, known as a pretty strong rider. And yeah, they didn't want to give him too big a leash. So they were brought back at 50K to go before the top of the last climb. And on this last climb, we saw an effort by Bahrain to push the pace, trying to drop Mads Pedersen, but it was to no avail. He was very strong and stayed in the group without any issues, and he quite handily won the sprint at the end, even though he was well challenged by Fred Wright. So first Mads Pedersen, second Fred Wright, and third was Vianney Vermeers, which was a bit of a surprising one. So it was not exactly as action-packed of a day as we saw. My pick for yesterday, Lawson Craddock, did try to bridge up to the three guys for a moment, but unfortunately he was unsuccessful and caught back by the peloton. So, that was today.
Wow. I was worried for a second, Larry, that you were going to come in a bit short there. You were going to come in 15 seconds short or so, and we were going to have to talk about, I don't know, cherries or ham or ex-girlfriends a la Fran Res. But fortunately, you saved us, you rescued us there. Larry, we have got a lot to get through this evening. So without further ado, let's hear from a few of the protagonists today. We mentioned Trek Segafredo, Mads Pedersen winning. Trek Segafredo have had a fantastic Vuelta a España. The way they've ridden for Mads Pedersen has been extremely impressive. We're going to hear from two of their riders who were in uncharacteristic roles today. Antonio Tiberi, the young Italian, I think he's 20 years old. And King Kenny Ellison, the friend of the cycling podcast, and again a rider who was pretty instrumental on a day that was not really ideal for a 52 kilogram climber. And finally, we're going to hear from the rider you just mentioned who finished third today, Gianni Vermeers of Alpecin de Koenig.
Thank you, this is my first time I do a lead out, and today was a very perfect day. All the day in front, we controlled the race. Mads was very confident in the legs, and he had a very perfect condition. Today we did a perfect work, I think, and we ended in the best mood.
Kenny, well, another stage win for the team, another day when Mads made you work, but you've been rewarded. I mean, how did you feel out there? Because your form's just been getting better and better throughout this Vuelta.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy. I mean, for the whole team, I'm really proud of the effort today, the collective effort from the first one to the last one. As I told you, the mountain stage this year, I try to save my legs for a day like today. So Matt is delivering behind, so I'm really happy, and today I'm proud to be part of the team collectively. I think we could have not have done much better, so really happy, and I'm happy to provide the support Matt deserves at the moment with the shape he got. Yeah.
What was the worry today in the bus? We saw at one moment Bahrain certainly came to the front, tried to make it hard, but what was the big concern this morning, if there were any, in the bus?
The profile. Look at the profile and I say, oh, is it not too hard, and do the GC guy will try to go full, and also one of the day we tried to do it, and like first week or something like this with 1P, and we were not in a good day and we did not manage to do it. So yeah, today is a bit the arc redemption when we did it well, because last time I was a bit disappointed to not manage to have good legs enough for Matt that day on this climb. So today we did it better, and I'm happy for that.
And on days like this, where is the decision, the impetus coming from to work for a sprint? Is it from Steven de Jong, the directors, or is it Mads that gets in front of everyone and says, look, today we can do this?
To be honest, it's a bit of both, because we have no GC aspiration, because Juan Pay has a lot of little issue here and there. So we decided to switch totally for Mads. So even for me, the mountain stage, I was like, Kenny, you go easy, and we try to do as much as we can in on a stage like this. So it's a new thing also for me to work on this side of the sport. But every chance we got with Mads, even if it's small, like today, if we were a file, no problem, we would have tried. And we said to ourselves, Mads is the best chance we have to win stages here, with the climber we are and the level in mountains. So Mads is the best chance we have to win, so we try everything to win with him.
Have you got any strength left for tomorrow?
We will see. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm reserving for Madrid, not for the sprint.
For me, actually, it was the last stage, because tomorrow is definitely too hard. And the last day, we go all in for another victory with them. So I'm happy I could take this third place. I didn't spoke a lot yet with Remco, but I finished him today with his victory yesterday, which was already great, actually. But Belgium, it would be really nice. There is a lot of pressure on Remco, but now he got a lot of critics already in Belgium. So now he's giving an answer.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. You can find out more about Super Sapiens at supersapiens.com.
El Diario Remco, the Daily Remco.
Obviously, and I mean, for sure, it's good for the head, it's good for the morale, but I'm gonna keep repeating, we have to be careful still for the next 2 days. I think for what we did the last 3 weeks already is really impressive, and a new step in our team development. But now it's all about keep fighting and keep the head strong, and two more days.
Well, Larry, that was our leader at this Vuelta a España, inching ever closer to becoming the first Belgian Grand Tour winner for 44 years, Larry, since Johan de Munck in the Pink Panther in the 1978 Giro d'Italia. That's an extraordinary stat, isn't it?
Yeah, that's actually pretty crazy. I was really surprised by that when I heard that sort of at the beginning of this Vuelta. Just because, you know, it's a country with so much cycling history and so many cyclists, I just expected there would have been one more recently than that.
Speaking of Belgium, I was getting some correspondence from some Belgian friends of the podcast, loyal listeners this morning. Charlotte Elton is someone who's contributed to the podcast in the past, notably with an excellent song about where we were going wrong with all of our pronunciations of Belgian riders at the Giro a couple of years ago. Anyway, Charlotte lives not far from where Remco is from, and there was some initiative today whereby all the kids, young school kids, were going to school dressed in red as a nod to what was happening in Spain. Charlotte said, also, we're very consistent in our Belgian bashing on the cycling podcast. She can tell that we don't have much time for Remco. I think that's a little bit harsh. Remco has certainly, well, I think he's grown on a lot of people in this Vuelta a España. As I've said many times, he's conducted himself impeccably in the mix zone in the mornings and in the afternoons after stages. Interesting, we just heard a bit of him this morning. I thought he was alluding slightly, and I've heard that privately he has also alluded to the fact that his team needs reinforcements for Grand Tours, will need reinforcements for Grand Tours next year. I don't think there are too many spots still up for grabs at Quickstep. I think their recruitment is pretty much done. But, I mean, they've got through this Vuelta a España. As Patrick Lefebvre told me a few days ago in our Encuentro del Día, where was that? Somewhere down on the Costa Blanca. He sort of said that a rising tide lifts all boats, that the team's level would rise to the level of Remco. And that's kind of been the case, hasn't it, Larry?
Yeah, you know, I think like they've done a really good job with the guys they have. But, you know, it's hard because, yeah, they don't have that same stage racing pedigree as Jumbo, for example. And, you know, I think they've always been a team that really focused on the sprints. So, you know, I guess with that, it's going to be hard to, you know, ride the way Jumbo rides or Ineos, for example. But they've definitely done a good job with the guys that they have at the race, that's for sure.
Larry, talking of riding sort of against one's nature or being made to ride against one's nature, we heard from King Kenny Ellison. Good friend of yours, isn't he, Kenny?
Yeah, yeah, friend he used to live here, here in Nice, so we used to train together quite a lot, but unfortunately he moved to Andorra a couple years ago now, so unfortunately I haven't seen Kenny as much as I used to, that's for sure.
But Larry, that experience, I would class you as a climber, an ace climber, a mountain goat, that experience of being a climber and being made, asked to ride for a sprinter, or, you know, getting onto the bus in the morning and not really knowing what your job is going to be, and someone, whether it's in the management or one of your teammates, has sort of put their hand up and said, look, tomorrow could be a good day for me, and all of a sudden you're entrusted with, as I say, riding on the front or riding on terrain that you're not necessarily best suited to. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is like, while I'm sort of a climber, I'm more of like an all-arounder. So I am able to help like in kind of a lot of different scenarios. So I have ended up helping like our sprinters before and stuff on the teams I've been on. You know, I'm not going to be the guy who's going to be the last lead out man unless it's like an uphill finish. But, you know, like a long uphill sprint or something like that. But, yeah, I've definitely helped quite a lot in the finishes leading into sprints, you know, up to like the last kilometer or something like that. But yeah, it's something I enjoy. In a stage like today, actually, it's a little bit different because as you saw, like they went pretty hard on that that last climb and, you know, whittled down the bunch quite a bit. And so in a situation like that, actually, that's a job that personally I really enjoy because if there's 50, I think there were 55 guys that finished in the bunch today. And if there's 55 guys in the bunch, it's actually like pretty simple to do a lead out. You just have to be strong. So yeah, it's not like you're bumping bars with all the lead out men because most of them would have been dropped today. And it's kind of fun to get involved like that. And on a day that's been super hard and you're in the last week of a grand tour, it's a bit simpler because you really just need the legs.
It's been notable in this Vuelta a España, Larry, how Mads Pedersen, I don't know whether it's Mads Pedersen and I sort of asked Kenny Ellis on this or whether it's the Directeur Sportif, but they've really rallied everyone around the same cause. And you can tell how much conviction they're riding with. I mean, I guess that comes naturally when you know you've got a leader in form. who is going to deliver. But I also suspect that in this case, Mads Pedersen's leadership qualities and his ability to get people, to get everyone on the same boat, that has played a big part as well. And I suspect that's not the case with all leaders. There are some leaders you would more readily sacrifice yourself for than others.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think like you definitely can see that a lot in certain teams is there are some guys that, you know, they go out of their way to just be so grateful, you know, or do things for the guys who helped them and stuff like that. And so, yeah, there are certain leaders that you're just so excited or, you know, and
who are
in
the best
end,
ones
like,
you've had? Who are the best ones you've
actually,
had?
Actually, I have to say Benoit Cosnefroid for me is like one of the best leaders I've actually had is just like a guy to ride for because he is just extremely grateful. And even when he was like, you know, pretty much like a neo pro, I remember we won the Tour de Limousin with him, you know, and, you know, so he would have been on like a neo pro salary, wouldn't have had that much. And I remember he like sent everyone a gift after the race, you know, and it wasn't like a giant race or anything, but, you know, he went out of his way to really thank everyone. And that's kind of just gone along. Yeah, I guess like every race I've done with him, you know, he's just so grateful for the work that you do. And, you know, he goes out of his way to thank you and to tell, you know, the team and the team boss, like, you know, how good a job each guy did, who did a good job and things like that. And, you know, that really means a lot to riders because sometimes if you help and, you know, you don't really get anything back or any feedback or anything, you know, it doesn't exactly motivate you to do the same thing again or, you know. He's someone who he really goes out of his way and appreciates
that.
What
was the gift, Larry?
Well, it was actually a Wonder Box. I don't know. Have you heard of that? I don't know if that exists in the UK.
No.
It's this thing in France where they come in different forms. But like this one, for example, was like, you get dinner for two at like a number of different restaurants around, you know, like nice restaurants like around France. Yeah, exactly. So things like, you know, it was like, you know, which was like, I just thought really nice for a guy who was like, you know, like a neo pro, not making very much money or anything, you know, to go out of his way to like do that, you know, for not even like the biggest race or anything. I just thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's been common practice for a while now in professional cycling to gift people watches, hasn't it?
Certainly yeah, unfortunately, the kind of... I've not been on one of the watch gifting ends, but, you know, that's okay.
I've heard of leaders giving people, buying people cars even in more extreme cases after world championship wins. But Larry, does that hold true then that you will work for a guy that you like much more than you will work for a guy that you don't like? I mean, have you had the experience
I think it's just like you might go the extra above and beyond, you know, to the depths of your capabilities, you know, for a guy that you like, you know, for a guy that's like your friend. Whereas like someone who doesn't, you know, isn't very gracious or, you know, if you weren't a big fan of them or something, you know, it's just, you know, you're going to do your job. You're always going to do your job. But there are very varying degrees of levels that you can do that job to. And, you know, I think a good leader is aware that that's the case. And they're going to, you know, I guess, motivate their guys to give every last, you know, bit that they can. And I think that makes a difference in the end.
Well, it's been a great Vuelta a España for Trek Segafredo. I guess they'll get another opportunity in Madrid on Sunday. I mean, Pedersen looks like the fastest sprinter in the race. Obviously, there'll be a few other guys who were dropped today who may be in with a shout, like Tim Merlier on Sunday. But Larry, a day like today, the way it was ridden, how much energy will that cost the general classification guys who will do battle? We think they'll do battle tomorrow on the last mountain stage of this Vuelta and the last opportunity to change anything on GC.
I mean, I think for the GC guys today was pretty easy. You know, I think if you're like one of the best climbers, to get in a 60-man group, you know, over a climb is not hard. So I think for most of the guys, they'll have been happy that it wasn't just an insane battle the whole day and that they could stay in the bunch somewhat calmly. I'm sure it was fast and I'm sure it wasn't like an easy pace, but, you know, I think there's something even the fact that there's just less stress when there's a team riding and you kind of know the foregone conclusion of the stage. I think there's something to that mental aspect that's a little more calming, and you don't have to worry about a fight, for the break or this or that or the other thing. You can just really focus on tomorrow. So I think probably a lot of the guys conserved energy, and if not physical energy, mental energy today to get ready for tomorrow.
Are you having much contact, Larry, with your teammates, with your AG2R teammates at the Vuelta?
No, not too much. I talked to Bob the other day, but that was pretty much it. I don't know. I haven't talked to them too much. I don't want to bother the guys in the race too much. I think, you're pretty focused on the race when you're there. I haven't talked to them too much.
What's the protocol with group chats at races? Is there a separate group set up on WhatsApp for every race, or is there a...
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so it's... And is the one that runs throughout the whole season when everyone's on?
There would be like a riders WhatsApp group that essentially if there is some kind of logistic thing or whatever that we need to talk about all the riders, we talk about that. And then, if someone wins a race, everyone's like, congratulations or whatever. But then when you're at the race, there will be, a group chat just between everyone who's at the race to discuss everything in the race and logistics and everything like that.
Who's the funniest, almost active person on the AG2R team group chat, and who's the person who it's impossible to get to acknowledge messages or respond to anything?
I would say probably a guy like Sean Pouzan's one of the guys who would respond the last. It's like there's always the same like three or four guys. If you're supposed to fill something out, for example, like prize money. To get the prize money, you have to fill out, some dumb form online that, is really, for some reason, complicated to, do correctly. There's always, the same three or four guys who are last. And I happen to be one of the guys who's a little bit behind on that. I'm usually in the last four. The guy who would be most on point and on top of everything is Nans Peters. He's a little bit OCD and really everything, has to be 100% dialed and perfect and whatever. So he is actually the guy who sort of arranges a lot of the logistical things like the prize money and things like that. And then if I was going to say the most funny, it's hard to say, but... if you're at the race, less on WhatsApp. We don't really joke that much. We don't really have that much banter going on the team WhatsApp group because there'd just be too many messages. But I would say at the race is one of the funniest guys is Hayes van Hecke. He's pretty funny. There we go. We just said a positive thing about a Belgian now.
Any examples of his material, Larry, before we conclude this part?
I don't know. I can't really think of anything, but he tells some stories and, he has a kind of a funny accent when he speaks French. And so it's just hilarious. He's just kind of a goofy guy. So sorry. I wish I could think of a story more quickly, but yeah.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, where we reach for our shovels and go digging for pop music gold in the dingy underworld of the Vuelta's official songs through the ages, lost in inebriated fantasies of Fernando Escartín's Macarena, Superman Lopez crumping across the plains of Castilla-La Mancha, or Marc Soler's Gangnam Style down the Paseo del Prado on Sunday night. Today, I wanted to try, Larry, to whip up some excitement ahead of tomorrow's supposed to be mountain showdown in the mountains to the northwest of Madrid, the Sierra de Guadarrama that we've mentioned many times during this Vuelta. So I'm going back to 1985, a year when the Vuelta's official song was provided by Juan Carlos Ramos Vaquero, better known in Spain as Iván. The singer had chosen the stage name to avoid confusion with the reigning king of Spain, Juan Carlos. Iván had once seemed destined for fame as a footballer, having played for Real Madrid's youth teams. His musical talent was spotted when one of his teammates told their father that Iván, then still Juan Carlos, wrote songs in his spare time. His 1985 official Vuelta song was called Baila or Dance. After superstardom in the 1980s and 1990s, Ivan emigrated to a quieter life in Australia, where his daughter Natalia Ramos is now a well-known actress. The 1985 Vuelta began in Valladolid with a TT prologue won by the Dutchman Bert Oosterbosch, who would tragically die of a heart attack 4 years later, aged just 31. The first week of the race was notable mainly for the emergence of a prodigious new Spanish talent, the 20-year-old Miguel Indurain. He took the jersey on stage, or the leader's jersey, the Mayotte Amarillo, yellow jersey, on stage two, held it for 4 days, and remarkably would never wear it again. By the time the race reached the penultimate stage and the Sierra de Guadarrama, a Scotsman, Robert Miller, led a Colombian, Francisco Pacho Rodriguez, by 10 seconds and the Spaniard Pío Ruiz Cabastani by just over a minute. But as detailed brilliantly by our great friend and leader Richard Moore in his In Search of Robert Miller, a Spanish armada consisting of José Recio and Pedro Delgado set sail just as Miller punctured at the foot of the Puerto de Cotos. Miller was initially unconcerned upon rejoining the main peloton, but a combination of some partisan Spanish TV moto pilots, a misguided blinking contest engaged by his Peugeot DS, and the suspicion that other teams had been paid by the Spaniards not to assist the chase ended up costing Miller the Vuelta and gifting it to Delgado. It would henceforth be known by many as the Stolen Vuelta, and one of many occasions when the champagne shower of Vuelta leader could already taste turned to acid rain on the Sierra de Guadarrama. Well, that's a bit bleak, isn't it? Acid rain. My word. Yeah. Larry, I don't know if we're going to see acid rain tomorrow on the Sierra de Guadarrama. I hope not, but maybe we'll see some drama. Maybe we'll see some
fireworks, I think.
Do you know what we will see, Larry? We're going to see Alejandro Valverde's last mountain stage in a Vuelta a España. And Valverde, 42 years of age. He's been an institution in Spanish cycling over the last 2 decades, as mentioned earlier in the Vuelta. His first Vuelta a España was 2002, when Juan Ayuso, who's currently third in general classification, was born. He was born during that Vuelta a España. Wow. Few highlights of Valverde's palmarès, 4 Tour de France stage wins, a Giro stage win, 12 Vuelta stages, 1 overall win. He's 3-time Spanish national champion, 5 Flèche Wallons, 4 Liège-Bastogne-Liège, 2 San Sebastians, 1 Worlds, a Dauphiné, a Basque Country, 7 World Championship medals. Also a guy with a controversial past, shall we say. We'll go on to talk about that in a minute. But we've been trying to talk to him for a while at the starts here at the Vuelta a España. And well, finally this morning, we did get to have a word with Valverde. I am going to live dub the interview. This is a new dubbing technique that we've been experimenting with on the Cycling Podcast during the Vuelta a España. So let's hear Alejandro Valverde. And I'm going to tell you what he said.
No, en general, todos los días, el cariño del público, las salidas, las llegadas, durante los pueblos, en los
puertos. He said, everything's been great up until now on the Vuelta. It's hard to choose just one thing that I've liked. Just the affection from the fans at the starts, at the finishes, in the towns, on the climbs. Every day has been fantastic. As for the decision to quit now, I've really put to bed any indecision about that. I've decided, and that's that. I think it's time. And I'm also enjoying this Vuelta because of how well Enric Mas is going and how well the team is riding. I don't know about legacy, I just hope people see that Alejandro Valverde has given all of himself to cycling and that I've left some good memories. What advice would I give to the emerging generation, the Ayusos, the Evenepoels? Oh, nothing. They look to me as though they're enjoying themselves. They're comfortable in their own skin and they just have to continue like this. They're big champions already.
Nada, yo creo que lo están haciendo muy bien, están disfrutando. Los veo tranquilos y nada, la verdad que son grandísimos campeones.
Vale, gracias.
Now, Larry, always difficult to evaluate Alejandro Valverde because there are a lot of people who say very positive things about it. However, those of us who have followed the sport or covered the sport for a long time cannot get one thing out of our head, and that is that he served an 18-month suspension in 2009. It was a belated suspension because of the events of Operación Puerto, when he was linked to the Spanish gynecologist Eufemiano Fuentes, and then DNA tests were done on blood that was found in Fuentes' apartment and clinic in Madrid, and it was proven to belong to Alejandro Valverde. He has admitted that he knew Fuentes, but he has never really admitted having cheated in any way. Larry, someone who only really started following the sport in 2012, how do you reconcile these not just two things, but multiple things? On the one hand, Valverde's palmarès, his longevity, the fact that by general consensus he's a nice guy who gets on with people in the peloton, and that slightly murky side to his past.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough. I mean, to be honest, actually, when I was 2012, I will say I remember Valverde back from the Lance days, because I did watch the Tour de France when Lance was doing it. And I remember this like young Spanish kid just starting who like had like a really good punch and was definitely challenging Lance on some stages and stuff. And I don't remember which tour that was. So that's actually my first memories of Valverde. And I remember being actually quite a big fan of him then. So yeah, you know, it's hard because obviously this guy, he crossed a lot of generations. So, you know, I don't think he's the only one that had a questionable past that many of us have raced with.
He's almost the last one left, actually. He's the last
That's maybe possible.
Yeah, he's the last sort of relic of that generation, and his retirement really is the last time where these questions will be asked and be put to guys like you or even younger riders. I asked about him today, and they will have that kind of currency, that relevance of being about someone who is still in the peloton.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess what a lot of guys would say in the bunch is like, say what you will about his past, but he's like a damn good bike racer. So, you know, I think everyone's well aware that, he was probably involved in some bad shit back in the day. Who knows? Hopefully, you know, he stopped that after. I have no idea. The one thing you have to admit is that he's just a really good bike racer. Beyond the physical part of it or anything, you know? And so I think people can appreciate how good of a bike racer he is and kind of like separate the fact that, he did what he did whenever he did it. So, I think it's tough, but I think if you were going to be a bike racer in the era that I have raced through, is like you have to accept that a lot of the guys that you're racing with would have gone through a different era, you know? They were still going to be in the peloton, and, you know, hopefully they just weren't doing the same things that they did before. So, it's the same thing. You know, a lot of the directors still in the sport, a lot of the staff were all involved in like that era that, I think the majority of the people involved in cycling were somehow involved in those sort of things. So it's something that, you know, you have to acknowledge happened. But we just have to be grateful that our generation doesn't have to deal with that. Or at least, you know, it's very possible to be a very successful bike racer without doing that. You know, I'm sure there's always going to be people who cross the line, you know, not just in sport, but in anything. But I think it's a lot smaller fraction now than it used to be. It is what it is. But you have to say that he is a really good bike racer, and he's a really classy bike racer. So, and he's cool to watch, you know, he's a good bike racer to watch. So I think that's kind of like, that's sort of my opinion. And I know a lot of guys share the same views as me.
Well, Larry, I suppose how you feel about him now and you feel about what are his real abilities, they're linked to your general feelings about how clean the sport is. We'll come on to that in a minute. Let's just hear what a few other people think of Alejandro Valverde. The last couple of days I've been speaking to riders who rode with him, raced with him, guys of his, what we would call his generation, younger riders. So here are a few of them. Juan Mangarate is now direct sportif at EF Education Easy Post. You'll hear his voice first, then Dario Cataldo, who was Valverde's teammate at Movistar and now rides for Trek Segafredo, and then Ben O'Connor, your teammate, Larry. Let's hear from that trio.
I don't know how big this job was for him, because at the end, I have the feeling that for him it was not a job. It was something that it didn't cost him energy. Like for him, it was kind of a game, you know. He had fun every day. He trains every day with 30 or 40 cyclotourist riders, you know. And he is not a rider that he was following a really specific plan during his career. And he is like all-star rider with his own feelings. And I think that's the secret. And then to have such a long career, you need to be really professional to take care about all the details. And I mean, if you see him, you see how skinny he is since the beginning of the year till the end. He's a rider that is, yeah. I mean, he's a reference for a lot of riders in the peloton. And I don't know, how long is his career? You know, probably better than me. Than maybe 17 or 18. I don't know years. Long his career, probably.
Juan Ayuso was born during the Vuelta a España that was Valverde's first, 2002.
He can be his father. If you have seen his how he was racing when he was young, he was like young, or in the first years, he was in the back of the peloton having fun and blah blah blah. And with new cycling we have, we never see him anymore in the back of the peloton. He is always ready, he's always competitive. He's racing with the whole team in front. This costs you energy, mental energy too, you know. But he found his comfort zone in front of the peloton. It's a reference, as I said before, to many riders.
Dario, this Vuelta is the last one for Nibali, for Valverde. You've been the teammates for both guys. You're carrying on, aren't you, next year?
Yeah, I will keep for normally other 2 years. So, and it's strange to see the big riders like them will leave cycling, and this is the last Grand Tour for them. And sometimes I speak with them in the group, also with Valverde. I ask, do you really realize that in 1 week all this is over, all the people, when we pass through the people on the roads? And you can read in their face that there's something that they already feel is sad at that moment. Yes, to realize that that all that story, all this racing since when they were a child, not only as a worker, as a professional rider, but since way they are kids, and this is going over, and you can read it in their face. They really take it as a game. They really enjoy the bicycle like a guy of 17 years old. So doesn't look 40 years old at all. So I think that is his secret, and also for sure because he have legs, he have good condition to do it, to enjoy it fully. And it's really nice to see a big champion like that to take cycling with that spirit.
Oh, Valverde, I mean, he's done everything. I mean, he's good in the bunch, he's got respect in the bunch, and he always does his job, whether it's winning races or helping others. So yeah. Is this his last race?
Last Vuelta.
Yeah, fair. Well, it'd be cool for him if he could win a stage to cap it off here in Spain. But yeah, I think he's got some big work to do for Enric today and tomorrow.
So, Larry, there we heard some interesting views on Alejandro Valverde and certainly the secrets of his longevity. Certainly from Juan Margarate, this characteristic that Valverde has always had of treating cycling like a game. We've always heard that, you know, he goes out in these big groups in Murcia and they're sort of lifelong friends, and they have these ad hoc impromptu sort of races, and he's not too scientific in his approach. But coming back to the question I sort of left floating, hanging in the air earlier, Larry, let's talk about the current state of cycling vis-a-vis doping. I've had conversations with you and a few other riders in the last few months about the level of testing at the moment. And I guess your confidence in how clean cycling is also very much linked to how much testing is going on, how solid you think the measures in place are to combat doping. Just talk to me a little bit about that and the trend that you've seen over the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there was quite a big change when we went from the CADF, I think it was called, the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation, to the ITA. So that transition happened, I don't know, maybe at the beginning of this year or the end of last year. I don't really know which. And yeah, like I think a lot of people mentioned, is there wasn't a very whole lot of testing for a while, which I think worried some people. But then recently they've definitely done the opposite. So yeah, now, I mean, I know I've been tested quite a lot, probably more than I ever have been in another year of my career. And that's like out of competition. And I know, like, yeah, a lot of guys I'm aware of have been tested quite a bit. So you know, I definitely think they're ramping that up. But, you know, I know, like, what I've read is that they're trying to sort of go at it from different ways. So, you know, not just like trying to get like positive tests, but using police and, you know, things like, you know, the raids that we've seen, you know, to try to attack it from a different way, which I think, yeah, could be effective. I'm not really sure. You know, I don't know. It's like, I really believe that the sport is the majority clean now. And yeah, like I just said before, you know, there's always going to be people who cheat in every walk of life. We're never going to see, you know, zero cheaters in our sport or in any other. But I'm 100% sure that you can win big bike races clean. And I have a lot of confidence in my teammates and my friends who I train with. And, you know, I ride with a lot of the best guys in the world here. So, yeah, I have a lot of confidence in the guys and a lot of confidence in the sport now. So yeah, for me, that's good. But yeah, obviously you never know what happens behind closed doors and there's always a possibility, but, I'd say for the most part, I have quite a lot of confidence that the peloton is,
I mean,
for the most part, clean.
Larry, just to pick up on something you said earlier, it was at the start of 2021 that the ITA took on anti-doping in professional cycling. But one thing we've said on the podcast a lot over the last couple of years is that we're deprived of the information that positive tests and doping raids used to give us, because inevitably, you know, if the top four in the Tour de France or four of the top 10 were testing positive for a particular substance, then you could reasonably draw conclusions about the other guys in and around them. And in the absence of any real positive tests for big riders in the last few years, we're sort of guessing, and you know, that can engender a level of optimism in the state of the sport. But then occasionally you have conversations, like I had a conversation with Michael Rasmussen at the Tour de France, and you know, I think Michael Rasmussen, now, there was a time when he would have claimed to know what was going on. Now Michael is honest and says, no, I've got no idea what is going on, but I can see that theoretically one could do this, this, and this. However, I would caveat that with the sense we all have that there has been a culture change, and that riders, teams, doctors are no longer minded to look for every single way where they can exploit, well, not just exploit rules legally, but illegally. And then, you know, there's another side to the conversation, which is about grey areas and TUEs and legal loopholes that one can possibly thread the needle through. I mean, just on that last issue, Larry, TUEs, well, the net has been sort of tightened on cortisone, but how confident are you that those things aren't being exploited?
I mean, that I have really no idea, but I will say probably like the whole cortisone thing with this year, you know, they like made the rule that was in place for MPCC teams before, in place for everyone, if I'm correct. So, you know, I think, pretty much now if a guy is going to take cortisone, he has to stop racing for a certain amount of days, correct, or, you know, like 8 days or something like that. So, you know, if that was being exploited before, hopefully, this rule will, you know, definitely help that. But yeah, I don't really know. You know, it's not something that I've been exposed to, but just because I haven't been exposed to it doesn't mean that it's not or hasn't been going on in the past. So surely it happened over the last, you know, decade. But I'm hoping now with these new rules that that is going to happen or is happening a lot less.
Larry, let's move on to something totally different to end this part. It's time for today's Encuentro del Día. It's with
But before that, can I just say one thing about Valverde that I actually really appreciate? I mean, the one thing that I noticed, sorry, this is kind of going back like two steps now, but just, I just love, there's all these sort of like myths about Valverde and his training and everything. And so, yeah, he rides with like this group of whatever. I mean, Garate said like 40 of his friends. I heard something like 20. But anyway, they meet at the same place every single day, same time. And he rides the exact same loop every single day. And they like sprint for town signs. And I guess at the end, he just kind of like slowly ramps up the pace on a climb until he drops everyone. And to me, that's just so cool that like that's how he still trains in today's age of like super scientific intervals, all this kind of stuff. And it works, you know? So I don't know. I just think that's probably one thing that like has really kept him going for so long is like, you know, he's literally just going out and riding with his mates every single day. And I think that's pretty sweet. So, yeah,
there is a romance to that, Larry. And I'm going to try to segue now into the Encuentro del Día. Another rider about whom there is a certain mystique, not least thanks to podcasts he's done with us. Hugh Carthy of EF Education Easy Post. I have very fond memories of the podcast I think he did with Mitch Docker, where he talked about how he likes nothing more after a big stage race than to go to some sort of grimy transport caf outside Pamplona and order a menú del día, the grimier and more unsophisticated or less sophisticated the better. Heard in the Vuelta a España a couple of years ago, hasn't been going quite as well for Hugh Carthy in this year's Vuelta. He's 25th on general classification, just under an hour behind Remco Evenepoel, but of course his team did have a stage win a couple of days ago with Rigoberto Urán. Here's Hugh Carthy.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, we talked earlier in the World Tour, Hugh, about your form coming in here. I mean, you were in the break yesterday. How has it gone the last week or so?
Yeah, getting better. Yeah, feeling good. I had a bit of a cold at the beginning of the second week, so it's a bit f***ed up. But yeah, I'm feeling good now, recovering well, and I don't think today's a day for me. It's probably just stay with Rigo and wait for tomorrow. So yeah, but feeling good and wishing you could go back in time, but yeah, it is what it is. I think we've had a good welter overall, and we've moved on quite quickly this last week. The morale in the team didn't dip, and we've been able to regroup the last rest day, and we've come out really well. I think yesterday we missed out on a good result with the way the race ended up, but with Rigo win and then the attitude of the team, I think something else good could happen between now and Madrid. So everyone's excited and yeah, happy to still be racing him.
Have you taken much from Rigo over the last two or three years? I mean, either advice he's given you or just things you've observed?
Yeah, I think in some ways quite similar. I think we're both sort of appear with results when you maybe at least expect it, you know. We're not those riders that just constantly churn out top fives, top three. We sort of pop up on our day, and I think to be able to do that requires patience and strong and holding nerve in times when it's difficult, especially now with the situation, the team and the World Tour. There's no moment like now to produce a big result, to sort of rally the team and get everyone going. So yeah, you have to learn that from someone like that. If, when things aren't going so great, you just got to ride the storm and be confident that you'll produce it when it matters. That's the biggest thing he's shown. But yeah, other than that, the racing, yeah, he races well. He's a good ambassador for the team and the sport, his country, and I think cycling as a community as well. It's not the primary thing in his life. I think it's important. I think he puts everything into perspective sometimes. So yeah, a lot of things.
I mean, he had that experience as well, finishing second in a Tour, and then people expecting him to follow up. I mean, since you're third place in the Vuelta, have you found any aspects of that difficult?
Yes and no. It's been, I think it was quite easier the following year, so last year beginning, because the confidence was still high. And then in the summer last year, I wasn't so good. I struggled a bit, and then when things got wrong, it was sort of hard to deal with. But and this year again, it's not been an easy year with illness and different things going on. So, but yeah, for me, the big turning point since then is the Giro this year. It wasn't the best result, but it wasn't what I wanted, but it was where I should have been, especially in the last week. So. Yeah, I think now is Grand Tours are hard, you know, they've always been hard, but I think now to aim for a top 5 or a top 10 isn't easy. You see now there are guys in the top 15 that are jumping in breaks, and there's 20 guys going for top 10, you know, it's difficult. So you've got to be realistic, you've got to be, it's difficult, especially after such a big result. But if you're a good rider, you do the right things. I think it does come back. It'll always end up there or thereabouts again. So, you just got to be patient and just keep doing things right. It'll be okay.
What have you got after this year, after the Vuelta?
I'm not entirely sure. I think maybe go to Italy for a couple of days and then Tour Lancawi. So it's not over yet, but I'm feeling good, especially the past few days. Felt good, and the motivation's come back, and yeah, looking forward to finish the season properly, and hopefully there's no stress in the winter, no problems. So that's the objective at the moment, is to enjoy it and get the most out of the races and have a nice long season. I think for me it suits me having a long season. The past few years having a shorter season for various reasons, it's not the best. I used to enjoy racing into end of October in China, and so over this year it'll be a good building block for next year as well. So yeah, looking forward to carrying on and finishing the season nicely.
What's the thing you most look forward to doing in the winter? Is there, you know, do you have a sort of day in your mind where you, I don't know, you're just watching films, or what's it?
I'm not much of a doer. I don't do much for holidays and stuff. I just
going away anywhere?
No, I've got a new house, so I'm going to go there, and it's just getting renovated at the moment. So
in Pamplona?
No, in England. I've got a dog, so with a dog you can't go anywhere. Just looking forward to being, especially when you spend all year away from England, it's nice to go back and spend a few months there and just not do anything.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Science in Sport have a discount code for all cycling podcast listeners, as I'm sure you know. It gives 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com, and the code is SISCP25.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So, Larry, la cena de ayer, we were in a place, what was it called, Oropesa, about 15 kilometers from the start today in Talavera de la Reina, and I had wild boar last night. I had some jabalí, not very vegetarian, I know, it's pretty good, and I also had some vegetable tempura, which I wasn't aware was a Spanish dish, but I've had that a couple of times. I'm not particularly healthy, I fully acknowledge, but we're only a couple of days from Madrid, so I'm looking forward to eating some greens in the not too distant future. Larry, tomorrow We are going to, a mountain range that has played host to some fantastic battles in the Vuelta a España. Usually late in the Vuelta a España, it's often decided the Vuelta a España. We alluded to it earlier in the Ritmo de la Vuelta. It's called the Sierra de Guadarrama. And before you present tomorrow's stage, let's hear from someone who hails from the Sierra de Guadarrama. It's Carlos Verona.
I'm from there. I think most of the cyclists that we are from center of Spain, we train there. Contador used to train there also for his biggest races. I think it's quite hard, no? Not the Alps, not the Pyrenees. But I think we have some good climbs. I think it will be a hard stage. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow. And I've been there watching all the races. I remember when I was 10 years old, watching there La Vuelta several times. And for sure it's a special place.
Well, Larry, that was Carlos Verona just telling us what an important location the Sierra de Guadarrama is, not only in terms of the Vuelta a España and its history, but also for the cyclists, the professional cyclists who live around Madrid. Carlos himself is from San Lorenzo de El Escorial, which is just at the foot of the Sierra de Guadarrama, and he'll have a key role tomorrow, I would suggest. But, Larry, tell us a little bit more about the stage.
Okay, so tomorrow is stage 20 from Moral Zarzal to Puerto de Navacerrada. It's 181 kilometers with 3,965 meters of elevation gain. So actually one of the hardest in terms of elevation gain of the entire Vuelta. So it's 5 climbs, 4 quite big ones and 1 a little bit smaller. And the last climb is 10K at 5.6%, but the last 3 climbs all come in like quite quick succession. So I believe we will see quite a battle that I could expect opening up pretty early. So it'll be a really exciting stage to watch tomorrow.
We'll be opening up early, and that will be instigated by Movistar?
No, I think it's going to be instigated by UAE. I just think, like we talked about yesterday, I think Movistar has too much to lose, and they're going to be pretty happy with the points they'll get from Enric Mas remaining in second place.
Well, as I said, the Vuelta has often been decided in these mountains. It was decided there, well, I'm just going to pick two at random. 1989, it was Perico Delgado against Fabio Parra, Delgado coming out on top. 2015, Tom Dumoulin against Fabio Aru. Aru came on top that time. But if we are looking to the past, it would be useful to have someone who's known, renowned for their wistful gazing. I think regular listeners know who I'm talking about. And I think we have possibly been joined by Fran Reyes. I can see him trying to log in. Fran, are you there? Fran, are you there? Are you recording? Are you in the sound booth?
Yes. Indeed, Mr. Friba. Hello, Mr. Larry Guarbas. Hello, dear listeners. Here I am, ready to help you out, tell what is going to happen in Madrid.
Are you wistfully gazing out of your window towards the distant peaks of the Sierra de Guadarrama with, images of Enric Mas storming the Vuelta a España on the Navacerrada tomorrow in your mind's eye, Fran?
Well, to be honest, even if as I'm as further as I can go with my imagination on this hotel room in Madrid, I frankly can't picture Movistar and Enric Mas going head on the offensive tomorrow. Actually, the only team that has an interest on going on from very early is UAE Team Emirates, because Miguel Angel López, he can wait for the final climb to beat Juan Ayuso. Carlos Rodriguez is more or less out of the equation because of his problems, his crash, sorry. And
chaps, yeah. I discovered today that Carlos Rodriguez has been informed that his nickname is now Sugar Man. and he's completely nonplussed and completely flummoxed by this. He has got no idea about its origin. Someone tried to explain to him that it was related to the documentary film Searching for Sugar Man about the artist formerly known as Rodriguez. But
From Michigan.
Yes, correct, from Detroit. But this raised not a flicker of interest.
Okay.
I mean, he's too young. He's a millennial, Daniel. We can't interest.
Not, he's not. He's very much not a millennial.
I think
he's
Gen Z, no?
Z, yeah.
Yeah. It's true.
I'm millennial.
I'm a millennial, Larry.
Yeah, you're a millennial too.
Yeah, I always mix up Seth with millennial. Sorry. Yeah. Well, what were you going to say, Daniel?
I don't know. Traditionally, at this point in the evening, you say something. You tell us a story about an ex-girlfriend.
I hope
that you've been on some kind of love safari with an ex-girlfriend in the Sierra de Guadarrama. But don't give us too many details about that.
No, you know what I was thinking about before tuning into the podcast was about two beautiful conversations. On one, I participated. The other one was overheard. You know that yesterday we were in Piornal, which was a very, very small town in the mountains in Extremadura. So what I love about these kind of finish lines, like the one we will have in Navacerrada tomorrow, actually, is that we arrive to very small villages and we take advantage of this condition of cycling as being the only sport that can visit you to your actual doorstep, you know? And there, as I was grabbing some watermelon from the press buffet, a couple of people approached me to say, "Hey, who do you work for?" "Well, I work for this and this other media." "Okay, can you please talk to Javier Guillén and tell him to come back next year? Because we really loved having the Vuelta here." This excitement is quite unique, but also better, even better. On these kind of small villages, everyone is out there helping out with the organization of the finish line, helping out to pull off the best Vuelta stage possible. So, and this also means that local people interact and they are smiling and they are happy. And yesterday I overheard these conversations between two of the volunteers that were working at the Vuelta. And the one woman was telling an older one that she was pregnant. That she was pregnant and he was carrying a baby boy. And it was so beautiful to feel this sense of community around cycling and the Vuelta. Is that wistful enough for you guys?
That is certainly very wistful. Yeah. And someone's offering me a sandwich right now.
Take it.
No, that's certainly very wistful and very romantic, Fran. I wouldn't expect anything else from you. But Fran, I think that's about as much wistfulness and romance as we can take for one evening. Our time is also nearly up this evening. So I think that concludes the evening's entertainment. I'm going to thank you both. Larry, we will be speaking to you again on Sunday for our grand finale. Fran, who knows what you'll conjure up for us tomorrow when we reconvene, I think, on the Puerto de Navacerrada.
Okay.
But I look forward to it. I look forward to it every night. So, chaps, it's good night from me. And
good night, everyone.
And good night from Fran, I think.
Good night.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.